All right, well, I'm back again with Mr. X, and today the plan was to just kind of have a nice general conversation about different topics, different elements of the UFO subject and its various subtopics. So one thing we were just going to kind of touch on at the beginning was the importance of a new energy paradigm and the ideas behind some of the exotic physics concepts that we've already addressed, for example, the EVOs, self-organized plasma. This is something that I am absolutely a student in. And to be honest, listening to Mr. X has been the most informative part of actually getting to know about these types of subjects. So I want to dive in, first of all, with Mr. X kind of giving an overview of what he thinks is the most important aspects of new types of physics concepts that might be breaking into the public sector. So here we are with Mr. X.
Hey, I'm glad to be here to try and answer your question. I think the first thing we should say is that there have been exotic energy technologies that have been developed and either abandoned, forgotten, or in many cases suppressed over the last 100 years or more, going all the way back to Nikola Tesla. There's been many of them. I would say probably in the last 20 to 30 years, the technology, and it's really a range of technologies called cold fusion or LENR, low energy nuclear reactions. There has been a great deal of research into that category of systems. But now we are basically discovering that EVOs or exotic vacuum objects, that's a topic that a very brilliant scientist named Kenneth Shoulders researched in the 1980s. EVOs are really at the heart of cold fusion and LENR. That's really what it comes down to. And I think now we have companies like the Sapphire Project, and even though they do not claim that they are utilizing EVOs with their technology, the Sapphire Project are utilizing self-organizing plasmas in their reactor to produce transmutation of elements and massive excess heat. And so we're moving in a positive direction.
Is this the kind of thing that you would see as the steps towards like room temperature, superconductivity, and that type of breakthrough?
What's really interesting is with these self-organizing plasmas, which I hope we'll get into a little bit more in the conversation, they may have superconducting properties because, for example, an EVO is just a self-organizing construct of electrons and positive ions, and they self-organize out of chaos. They are working against entropy to self-organize, and they can develop a very narrow membrane of electrons, but they're not really individual electrons anymore. Around the exterior, they have lost their individual identity. They have became more like a Bose-Einstein condensate, and they may have superconducting properties, and that may be one of the reasons why EVOs, exotic vacuum objects, and there's other names for EVOs. You can call them plasmoids, you can call them erzions, you can call them by a bunch of different names. But these EVOs produce a wide variety of anomalies that have been detected over and over again. And I think it's part of that superconductive nature of the exterior membrane that gives them some of those abilities.
So with the Sapphire Project, do you see that as probably the most notable public endeavor that's bringing us towards a new type of paradigm for energy?
Oh, as of right now, I would say definitely the Sapphire Project, when it comes to open, fairly well known, at least in certain alternative energy circles. The broader public is not aware of the Sapphire Project, but in alternative energy circles, it has became it's very talked about. And the Sapphire Project is probably our best hope right now in the white world for a breakthrough energy technology. They have a fantastic laboratory up in Canada, and they can repeatedly produce a self-organizing plasma. They have a big reactor, and they have two large cathodes, disc-shaped cathodes, and then between it they have an anode, and the anode can be of various materials. And basically, when they power it up, a self-organizing plasma wraps around the center anode, and it's called double layers that form. These double layers have positive ions on one side and electrons on the other side, and there are layer after layer nested within each other of these double layers. And when those double layers, when you increase the input current to a certain level, the magic happens, so to speak, when these double layers collapse very close to the surface of the anode, and there is a very sharp voltage gradient that you can measure with a Langmuir probe right near the surface of the anode, and it glows brilliantly bright. And when that happens is when they detect the transmutations, not only on the surface of the anode, but also in the gaseous environment of the chamber. And also they produce massive amounts of excess heat. And they have measured this over and over again. They know how to reproduce it. They know the exact gas combinations, such as, for example, combinations of hydrogen and nitrogen and argon they frequently use, and other combinations as well. And when you have these conditions, it just starts these reactions going. We don't understand everything behind these reactions at the, you know, atomic and subatomic level, but they happen because they can measure the excess heat. They can measure the transmutations. Elements that were not on the anode originally afterwards appear on the anode. Elements that were not in the gas of the chamber beforehand appear in the gas in the chamber. So I believe, you know, they're our best hope at this time for a clean, cheap, safe source of energy.
So for people that don't have an extensive research or academic background in physics, can you kind of in like layman's terms break down what the practical applications of what the Sapphire Project are doing with this whole double layering and using self-contained plasmas? What are the practical applications of it?
Well, everybody has always talked about, you know, hot fusion as being the energy source of tomorrow, that in some future world that we would have hot fusion generators that would produce huge amounts of energy, that would be the savior of our civilization. However, there's problems with hot fusion. First of all, they cannot get hot fusion reactors to work. Various governments around the world have spent billions and billions of dollars annually on hot fusion reactors, and they may be able to produce some hot fusion reactions, but the problem is that they cannot reach break even, or if they do, it's only for a tiny fraction of a second, you know, maybe milliseconds. And they're always saying that they will be able to commercialize it in 5 years and 10 years and 20 years, but it never happens. There's just too many barriers. It's too expensive. It's too difficult. One big reason hot fusion is so difficult is because you have to use external magnetic fields to contain this ultra hot plasma within the reactor. What's so brilliant about the Sapphire Project is that you don't have to use external magnetic fields, either from traditional non-superconducting conductors or superconducting materials. You don't have to produce an external magnetic field. You let the double layers contain the plasma for you, because the region within the double layers, the plasma becomes extremely dense. It self-segregates into those areas. Actually, different elements will self-segregate from the general atmosphere of the reactor into different layers of these double layers going towards the anode. And then when they collapse, you get an extremely dense layer very close to the surface. And of course, that's when the anomalies start to take place, such as transmutations and excess heat. And just imagine that in the future, you might, and this technology is perfectly scalable. self-organizing plasmas, you can produce them on any scale, from the nanoscale all the way up to potentially the galactic scale and every level in between. So just imagine in the future that you could have, instead of a, you know, backup electrical generator that uses kerosene or gasoline or natural gas, you could have one that just used hydrogen and argon and a few, you know, basic gases, and it produced a self-organizing plasma, and it could produce power without a recharge for many, many months or years. And you could produce cars that could have one of these self-organizing plasmas, or what I like to call it, a macro scale EVO in the core, that would be producing energy. So you could have a car that could drive across the country many times over before maybe switching out to a new fuel container, you know, to put a new fuel cartridge in. It would completely revolutionize energy. It would, number one, it would make it dirt cheap. Number two, it would reduce the ecological impact and environmental impact of conventional energy, because this is completely clean. There are no emissions. There's no CO2. There's no particulates. You know, there's no heavy metals or toxic elements in the ash like in conventional power plants. So this would be a clean, safe source of energy. Also, it would decentralize energy. Right now, we depend on a power grid where we have, you know, one part of the country sometimes will have to borrow energy from another part of the country. And it creates a huge vulnerability, because if one part of the grid goes down, theoretically, another part could go down. Or you could look at it even at a neighborhood level. You know, if a branch falls down across the street over a power line, not only will your neighbor's power will go out, but your power could go out. Everybody on your street, perhaps even your entire neighborhood, could go out. But if every home had its own generator, then that would no longer be a problem. Just think about during hurricanes or natural disasters or earthquakes. Just imagine if people didn't have to worry about the power going out and the power could stay on in an emergency. You know, for example, in Puerto Rico, when they've had some disasters in recent times, or the Bahamas, their power was out for an extended period of time. And in some areas, it probably still is out in the Bahamas. But just imagine if they had had you know, portable energy generators utilizing this phenomena, they would not have had, obviously, they would have had destruction and many homes would have been destroyed, but they would have, you know, the homes that survived would have still had power. So it would completely change everything. And even for space travel and space exploration, which is one of my favorite topics, having this sort of energy technology, you know, and we haven't even, you know, touched the topic of, you know, anti-gravity and the control of mass and inertia and gravity yet. But even for conventional space travel, with one of these generators, you could power a base on the moon. Even if you use rockets, which would be extremely primitive, and I think it would be ridiculous, since the special access programs already have had anti-gravity vehicles since the 50s and 60s, but even if you did take a rocket to go to the moon and set up a base with one of these power plants, you could have a clean source of energy that would produce way more power than solar panels. And you could harvest fuel from the lunar surface as well, because there's portions of the moon that have water ice. And so that would be a source of hydrogen. So basically, for energy, this phenomena of the self-organizing plasma is really the future. All these other technologies you hear of, solar power, you know, wind power, geothermal energy, biomass energy, there's, you know, there's all kinds of different things. They're going to all be made obsolete by these self-organizing plasmas that produce energy either via inducing safe, clean nuclear reactions, or potentially tapping energy from the vacuum or the ether itself.
Yeah, something I actually wanted to ask you is if the technology in whatever format that had some form of interstellar capabilities, like we actually had that technology in the public sector, how do you actually realistically see something like that being integrated into society? Because, you know, I mean, everyone would love to be able to have access, you know, to a spaceship, but you, unless the control mechanisms that are in place at the moment are dissolved and we're given an entirely new system, based on what we have to work with right now, it's very unlikely that you would see a fully commercialized, viable anti-gravity or interstellar platform available to every consumer. So do you see it as being maybe commercial space flight and integrated into maybe the military and private kind of travel and transport, and maybe not just available to everyone at once? Because, I mean, based on the world that we have at the moment, at least, without looking into a completely different world that we don't have already, it's unlikely that they would that would happen, because everyone would just kind of fly away from the planet.
Well, it's unlikely in the immediate, very short-term future. You know, if disclosure happened tomorrow and they admitted that craft and vehicles like the Fluxliner Alien Reproduction Vehicle and the TR-3B, which Tom DeLong of To the Stars Academy said repeatedly in 2016 on programs such as Coast to Coast AM and Fade to Black with Jimmy Church, he said that he was told by his insiders that we had cracked gravity control, that vehicles like the TR-3B were indeed real, that they figured out how to do this. And he repeated it on Coast to Coast a couple of times, that we have cracked gravity. So if that came out tomorrow, it wouldn't be an instantaneous transition. I mean, it's not going to be next month Ford is going to offer a flying station wagon, you know, that you can go to the moon in. However, it does open up that possibility for the future. I think in the short term, every country in the world, the governments of the world, would start building anti-gravity vehicles, and private corporations, and I don't mean just the aerospace corporations right now that are managing some of these special access programs, but also other companies that are not in the loop will start building these. So very quickly, we could have commercial vehicles that could, you know, literally fly to Mars in a day or less, you know, that could go to the asteroid belt. And instead of mining on the Earth, which produces, you know, pollution and ecological destruction and does all sort of harm, you could go to the asteroid belt and you could pull back an asteroid, a small one even, into lunar orbit or Earth orbit. And from a very, very small asteroid, you could get billions upon billions of dollars of precious metals, rare elements, and, you know, and rare isotopes. You know, it would completely revolutionize mining. And also, it would allow for, you know, NASA, as it exists right now, would become obsolete, because, you know, anyone, any of these small companies that wanted to rent one of these vehicles, or if, you know, if maybe if you're a medium-sized company or large company, you could build your own. You could, you know, take a survey of Mars or survey one of the moons of Jupiter, or even travel to the outer solar system. Everything becomes possible when you have the ability to utilize these technologies, because right now we're so limited with rocketry-based systems. Even the most sophisticated rocketry-based system, even if it was a fusion rocket, we're still going to be very limited. Travel around the solar system will be slow and tedious with the best rocket imaginable. But if we could have systems even that performed even a fraction as well as the Tic Tac, because remember, the Tic Tac UFO that flew over the Nimitz carrier group off the coast of California It was analyzed, and at a minimum, with conservative figures, it could accelerate at least up to 200 G at a rate of 200 gravities. And with constant acceleration of just 1 G, you can be, depending how Mars is aligned with the Earth in the orbits and everything, at just 1 G, you can be at Mars in a week or less. And if you could just go, let's say, 10 G, that means you could be at Mars in a day, maybe. I mean, we don't even need tic-tac level anti-gravity performance. With just a fraction of the performance of the tic-tac, we could colonize the solar system. We could travel across the solar system, explore the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. You know, we could do anything we wanted to in the solar system. And of course, if we could build craft that had faster than light capability, which these craft can achieve because they are manipulating the fabric of space around themselves, so they have a bubble where the etheric density has changed, so they are not actually traveling faster than the speed of light. They are, the speed of light has simply changed in their bubble or in the region in which they occupy. So, but we could potentially go beyond our solar system. You know, there's a planet in the closest star system to Earth, around Proxima Centauri. It apparently is approximately Earth-sized and in the habitable zone of Proxima Centauri. So we could explore that planet. We don't know if there's life on it or not, because that star emits an abundance of X-rays. So it would take a pretty thick atmosphere to protecting life forms on that planet, unless, of course, A, they evolved some, you know, defense mechanism against, you know, X-rays and radiation, or, you know, aliens from another solar system somewhere colonized Proxima B and, you know, built a habitat that could shield from, that could shield the residents from these X-rays and other types of radiation. So I hope that answers that question.
Yeah, something that I wanted to draw on in regards to spaceflight anyway, which kind of segues kind of nicely into something I wanted to talk about, was advanced metamaterials and the whole discussion around how these types of very complex, isotopically re-engineered materials, such as the bismuth magnesium zinc sample, being studied by TTSA. Do you think that these types of materials are necessary for advanced space flight? Do you think that you could actually make these types of vehicles and that it would be durable outside of, you know, our atmosphere and traveling at the insane rates of speed that some of these crafts do, without having to have something that is apparently at this time too advanced for our metallurgists, for our engineers to create?
I think the truth, from all the research I have done and all the people I've talked to and all the discussions I have had, I think the truth is that it's not nearly as complicated as they, the powers that be, would like to make it seem to build an anti-gravity vehicle. I don't think it requires ultra-advanced metamaterials that would require cutting-edge lithography technology. Basically, it all comes down to the manipulation of the vector and scalar potentials. And I explained this once before in the previous interview with you, but I think it's important enough that I explain it again. Maxwell, the original electrodynamicist who came up with the original Maxwell equations. And I want to say this was in the 1800s. I don't remember the exact date. I'm just going to throw a date out there, 1875. It could have been before or after that, but it was a long time ago. In his original equations, empty space, even the regions between stars or between galaxies where, you know, there's not even interstellar dust, space itself is filled with a type of medium, some type of substance that permeates everything. You can call this the ether. You can call this the electron positron sea. You can call this the active vacuum, the zero point energy field. There's tons and tons of names for it, but he claimed that it existed. And in his equations, to define the movements and pressure of the vacuum of this universal medium, he came up with what's called the vector potentials, or the magnetic vector potential, and the scalar potential. The vector and scalar potentials describe the properties of the ether. The scalar potential could be considered if you were under the surface of a river. Imagine the Colorado River or some other large river, and you're under the surface and you feel pressure from the water pushing around you from all directions. That would be the scalar potential. Basically, it would have to do with the density and the pressure all around you from this medium. The vector potential, a vector means it has a direction. So the vector potential would mean the flow of that medium in a certain direction, the movement of it. And so the scalar and vector potentials were considered by Maxwell to be real, and that the vector potential was basically the heart of electromagnetism. You know, a magnetic field, according to Maxwell, was basically just the curl or the twist of the vector potential. So really, in reality, there is no magnetic field in a separate entity from the vector potential. It's just a different manifestation of the vector potential. And what happened was, around, I want to say, a little bit after the turn of the century, the ether theory, the idea there was a universal medium that permeated everything, even between the subatomic particles in your and the atoms that make up your body, that idea of the ether fell out of vogue, and it became less popular, and mainstream scientists dismissed it. And then not long after that, a scientist by the name of Heaviside, he gutted Maxwell's original equations. He reduced them in number. He used a different type of math to lay them out, and he eliminated the vector and scalar potentials. He went so far to say that he murdered the vector potential. That was his own words. He despised them because all he wanted to do was to dumb it down enough so that people could hook up and wire up cities with, you know, ordinary electricity. That's all he cared about. So he just gutted it down, simplified it, dumbed it down, and just eliminated the vector and scalar potentials. But that was a travesty. That was what, in my opinion, set humanity back. Because understanding how to manipulate and control the vector and scalar potentials is the key to controlling apparent mass, inertia, and gravity. You see, inertia, mass, and gravity are all different manifestations of the scalar and vector potentials, which is, you know, the pressure and the movements of the ether. You know, one thing you have to realize here, and try to conceptualize this, the same force that pushes you towards the surface of the earth, the same force you feel when, you know, you try to pull apart two permanent magnets, and the same force you feel with your body when you slam on the brakes of your car, they're all the same force. They're just different manifestations of the scalar and vector potentials. It's not they're fundamentally different. They're fundamentally the same. They're just variants of each other. And that's a critical concept that people need to realize. And gravity control started, gravity control research started before Roswell in the United States. Townsend Brown was a famous scientist that started with gravity control. But I think there were other efforts that we may not know about because they could still be highly classified. But then the crashes of the 1940s started happening. In Cape Girardeau, Missouri in 1941. Then there was a UFO crash allegedly in 1945 in San Antonio, New Mexico. And there's probably other ones too. And then we have the crashes of 1947 in Roswell. And there was possibly another UFO crash, before the Roswell crash in 1947. There was a long series of them, you know, and I shouldn't even forget to mention the 1948 Aztec UFO crash. If you're interested in that, check out the great books by Scott and Suzanne Ramsey. They have written books about the Aztec UFO crash. There's a lot of evidence for it that it really did happen. But after all of these crash recoveries that extended into the 50s and maybe even the 60s or beyond, we really don't know how many of them there were, but there were a bunch of these crashes. Governments, I think primarily the United States, they started these black projects, and they started working on gravity control. And they looked at these craft and their propulsion systems, and they started trying to figure out how they work. And by the late 50s or early 60s, we had built the first Fluxliner ARV. It seems like the Fluxliner ARV, which you can go to Google, and if you do a search for the Fluxliner ARV, there's a documentary called Zero Point, the Fluxliner ARV, and you can watch it on YouTube. It's an absolutely fantastic documentary about this craft. There's a lot of evidence for it. They basically were able to build these vehicles. And the Fluxliner ARV, for example, utilized it had a couple of different systems. I'm only going to describe the main propulsion system. In the Fluxliner ARV, in the central column, there was a self-organizing plasma in the central column. It was specifically of the element mercury. And apparently the scuttlebutt is, from people who have been talking about this, that it was the mercury isotope, specifically 199. And this central column produced a bubble of vector potential around the craft. And so it was almost like a warp field from Star Trek, except it does everything. Instead of in Star Trek where you need a warp drive, you need an antimatter reactor, and then you need, you know, inertial dampeners so when you accelerate, the crew doesn't go splat against the bulkhead and then the episode's over. And so you don't need deflector shields to make sure, you know, grains of dust don't blow holes in the ship at light speed. And then you need all kinds of other systems. No, this does it all in one. This bubble of vector potential. Well, the plasma core produces the energy. It extracts energy from the vacuum. So the Fluxliner ARV, once you got it started, it was self-powering. Apparently, the faster it went, the more energy it extracted from the vacuum. And it allowed for propulsion. It allowed, you know, it nullified the inertial forces so the occupants would not feel the craft accelerating or stopping or changing directions. It did everything in one. And I would like to say one thing that's interesting is all the properties of mercury. If you look at mercury as an element, especially when it comes to self-organizing plasmas and how it could be used for a macro EVO, it's really the optimum element. I'm not saying other elements could not be used or combinations of other elements, but mercury is pretty unique. For example, mercury is a very heavy element, and that would allow for a large difference between the mass of an electron and a positively charged ion of mercury. Because, you know, when you have an atom, if you strip an electron off, then the remaining portion, the protons, the neutrons, and the remaining electrons will have a net positive charge. So you want as large of a difference in mass between the ion and the electron. And this is important because, for example, hydrogen by itself is not very efficient at producing a self-organizing plasma. So you really want that large difference in mass between the electron and the ion. Also, what's important is mercury is a liquid at room temperature, which is really important. But it also has a low vaporization point so that it can exist in a gaseous state at relatively low temperatures. And that's important if you're trying to generate a plasma. Go ahead.
I was told recently that there was excavations in China in like the massive pyramids that they have in China, and a lot of pools of like lakes of mercury were actually discovered inside some of the excavation chambers. And I know it's a little bit far out, but you know, maybe it could even link back to some of the things spoken about in regards to Vimanas in the Sanskrit and mercury engines being used for, you know, previous UFO technology, essentially.
Well, it's very possible if ETs were visiting this planet for hundreds or thousands of years, that if they were having to, you know, build spaceships here, or if they were using mercury as a fuel, even though it would have lasted a very, very long time, or if they were mining it for use elsewhere, or getting humans to mine it and refine it, it's possible that, you know, there could be a connection between the mercury that has been found in various ruins and pyramids and UFOs. There's a possible connection there. But I was also just going to say, too, is mercury can also be what's called doubly ionized, which means the two electrons in the outermost shell orbiting the atom in the outer shell, those two electrons can be removed. And when that happens, you create a doubly ionized mercury ion, and this makes it unreactive to other elements. So it makes it chemically unreactive. Also, what you have left in that situation is, with those two removed, the next electron shell is completely full, and that makes it what's called a pseudo-noble gas. It gives it a pseudo-noble gas configuration. And we know from Kenneth Scholder's work on EVOs and William Bostick's work on plasmoids that heavier noble gases such as xenon, krypton, argon can help with the formation of self-organizing plasmas. So basically, the mercury vapor, when it's ionized, would function as like a noble gas, except it would be even heavier than any other noble gas except for radon, which I don't think, you know, many people would want to experiment with due to its, you know, radioactivity and toxicity. Mercury, of course, isn't really super safe either, but compared to radon, I think it's much easier to handle. When I say handle, I don't mean literally touch it, because you shouldn't do that, because some forms of mercury can actually be absorbed through the skin and cause major health problems. But I think mercury would be easier for a laboratory or a special access program to deal with than radon. Also, finally, I was just going to say mercury also has a magnetic moment. And that means when it is subjected to a magnetic field, it can be spin polarized, which means the ions in a mercury plasma can have their nuclear spins made to align with each other. And that apparently is one aspect of what allows the self-organizing plasmas to form. Also, mercury isotope 199 has a 1/2 integer nuclear spin, which would extend the relaxation time, or in simple terms, help the plasma to remain spin polarized for longer. And basically, when you do this and you have a self-organizing plasma, it's going to have that, like I mentioned earlier, this outer layer of electrons, which are no longer individual electrons, but they have lost a portion of their individuality, and they have become more like Cooper pairs and have formed a Bose-Einstein condensate. And it's this superconducting layer that seems to be able to interact so strongly with the vacuum. So if you can spin this plasma ball up, you can create this bubble of vector potential around your craft and create all the effects, you know, that we have talked about in this discussion so far.
I have to admit, I've always been fascinated by mercury. Like, I just think it's such an amazing looking thing. That sounds it sounds so unintelligent in retrospect to what you've just been saying about it, but that's all I have to contribute to that, folks.
Oh, well, Mercury is fascinating. I mean, it is pretty. It is very interesting. It's electrically conductive. It's, you know, and it has a low melting point. So that's why, you know, you'll see some people on YouTube, you know, perhaps irresponsibly, depending on how careful they were being, you know, almost, you know, playing around with it. And, you know, that's kind of dangerous.
But yeah. What's your opinion on some of the, have you seen many of the videos? There's quite a few of them. And in fact, Stephen Greer actually, I remember, I'm pretty sure this was in Sirius, not Unacknowledged, but in Sirius at the end, he had like a series of videos of people on YouTube, just, you know, basically garage inventors who were creating forms of over-unity systems. Have you seen any of those online?
I've studied many, many, many different apparent over-unity systems. There's many different classes of alleged over-unity systems. This is a subject in and of itself, to talk about all these different claims. You know, to begin with, I would say the majority of these claims, I won't give a specific figure, but most of the claims you see are total bunk. Some of them are just completely intentionally fraudulent to get clicks, to get people to watch the videos or to go to their website or to buy their book or instruction manual. You would not believe how many wacky claims for, you know, free energy devices exist where they want you to go to their website. They'll make some kind of fake video and, you know, and have a narrator talking about the advantages of this technology and try to get you to buy their ebook for $19.99 that will tell you how to make your house go off the grid. And it's all it's all bunk. It's all a lie. But then there's a lot of people that really do think they have an over-unity technology. And there's all sorts of different devices people have built. And many of these people are just producing measurement errors. They're not calculating their input energy or their output correctly. And they have not done rigorous enough testing to really accurately measure their inputs and outputs. So they're just, you know, mistaken. But then there are some legitimate over-unity technologies. And when I say over-unity, you know, over-unity is a very general term. I should be speaking in a more precise manner. But, I mean, there's different classes of legitimate ones. For example, you know, there's many different types of cold fusion or LENR, low energy nuclear reaction systems that have been built in the last, you know, 30 years since 1989 when Pons and Fleischmann came forward to discuss their classic system. You know, when it comes to, you know, co-fusion systems, there's been many different types. There have been, you know, classical electrolytic co-fusion systems where you have an electrolysis system where you have, you know, you're trying to get hydrogen or deuterium to load into palladium. Then you have, you know, various powder-based systems where you're trying to, you know, it's a gaseous environment and under heat and pressure and sometimes electromagnetic stimulation with radio frequencies or microwave frequencies. You're trying to get hydrogen or deuterium to load into metal powder. Sometimes you're using what's called reverse spillover catalyst to try and you coat the main powder that you're trying to use with these spillover catalysts, even smaller particles, because the whole process of getting hydrogen or deuterium into the metal lattice is very difficult, and this can be used to split the molecular hydrogen or molecular deuterium into atomic hydrogen or atomic deuterium. What that means is instead of hydrogen and deuterium, they like to be in pairs, two atoms together. So, but to get them to go into the metal, they have to split into two. And so the spillover catalyst can help with that. Other LANR researchers have found other ways to produce atomic hydrogen so that it can more rapidly penetrate the surface of the metal. But even before you get to that stage, you have to go through rigorous procedures to degas your fuel powder. You have to go through processes where you let the hydrogen go in and then go out, in and out, because every time you do that, you're deforming the lattice. You're creating these little nanobubbles within the metal particles. There's different names for them, such as superabundant vacancies. There's many different, you know, there's a lot of terminology, different theories about what's happening. But basically, in all these different methods, where you're using physical metal and trying to pump hydrogen into the metal, you can produce excess heat. Many people have produced excess heat, but at the same time, it's very, very tricky. It's complex. It's difficult. There's many things that can go wrong. And so it's very real, but the reproducibility of these classic electrolytic and powder-based coal fusion systems haven't always been high. So now we have a few researchers like Andrea Rossi, and we have other researchers such as, other groups like the Sapphire Project. They have switched over to pure plasma-based systems, where no longer you're trying to load hydrogen into metal, either electrolytically or with gas loading. Instead, you're just producing a plasma ball, a self-organizing plasma, or a macro exotic vacuum object, EVO, in a reactor. So you're bypassing all the hard parts because you're getting to the core of what's happening. And instead of producing, thousands and thousands of little tiny nanoscale EVOs in a metal lattice in a fuel particle, you're just creating a macro scale, centimeters or larger in a reactor, and allowing it to do its thing and produce energy. And I really like what the director of the Sapphire Project, Montgomery Childs, I love what he has to say about how they go about creating their self-organizing plasma. They basically, and this is paraphrasing a little bit, so this is not an exact quote, but basically they kind of treat it like it's a life form. It's not really a life form, but they treat it like it is, and they just give it what they think it would like. They give it the conditions. They give it the food. That would be the combination of gases in the reactor. They give it the electrical input, just what they think it would like, and then it does everything for them. They don't have to force anything.
Well, this is actually something that this is something you've touched on before, and actually, I wanted to bring up the fact that the Sapphire Project and the EVO phenomena and what they seem to be doing, from what you've said before previously, it's a simpler way of getting to the type of technology we're looking to get, especially in retrospect to things like the patents that have come out from the Navy, from Salvatore Pi, in regards to kind of like a electromagnetic compression of fusion and inertial dampening. You have said before that you do consider the patents that's come out from the Navy to be essentially correct, but with too much science in it purposefully to confuse and make it seem like it's more complicated. So is that something that you still believe, that it's probably being made out to be a more complicated process, and the Sapphire Project seems to be streamlining that process?
Essentially, yes, but I want to specify something. My guess, because I have no evidence to the contrary whatsoever, is that Salvatore Pace is being completely honest. He's completely sincere. He's not trying to deceive or manipulate or confuse anyone. My opinion is that his patents are his own ideas, his own concepts. But I think my personal opinion of them is that they are way overly complicated. You don't have to go to such extremes. You can build much simpler systems. If you look at the EVO phenomena, and the connection to the vector and scalar potentials. And if you look at the different topics we've been talking about, and you don't, all of his various devices, I would say you can go about gravity control, you can go about, you know, unlimited clean energy in a much more simple manner. I think the military, the Navy, has been pushing his patents forward because they know it's overly complicated. They know that it's, you know, by pushing his patents forward, they are allowing certain concepts to percolate to the mainstream that, yeah, gravity control is possible. Inertial control is possible. Yes, clean nuclear energy is indeed possible. You know, controlling the vacuum, engineering the zero-point energy field, all this is possible. But the way he is conveying it is not the way they've already done since the 50s and 60s. They know it's a misdirection. Not that his patents necessarily wouldn't work. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that they have their own systems that are very different and much simpler than what he has conveyed. And so they're letting his patents go out because they're not worried about Russia or China or Asia, you know, any other Asian country or Middle Eastern country looking at his patents, because it's not going to lead them in the optimal direction, put it that way.
Who do you think is actually further ahead in the game in regards to countries? I mean, my bet would be between America and Russia, but do you have a difference of opinion?
I would guess probably so, but I wouldn't even like to say America and Russia, because in reality, the American government has lost control over these programs. You know, the 99% of Congress, the Senate, most likely the past several presidents, they don't have control over this. You know, 99% of them know nothing about it. And the very, very few that might have an inkling or have been briefed, they have zero control. There are small groups. When I say small, we don't know their exact size, but there are control groups that manage these programs within these private aerospace corporations and other corporations. And I guess what I should say is that it's fell into its own private bubble. So when we can't say the United States really has these technologies, because it's been the control over the entire UFO topic has been stripped from the official government, of the official military. Okay? The military as a whole, I don't believe, I could be wrong, but I don't believe the official military actually has access to these technologies and these programs and the truth about the UFO topic. It's these narrow, you know, small groups of elitists that have taken it upon themselves to make decisions for everybody, not just for American citizens, the taxpayers, but also for all of humanity. And it's really an outrage, because I don't think that we know it's not constitutional. And special access programs were never meant to basically strip away control over such important topics away from democratically elected officials. That's not what special access programs were ever meant to do, but that's what has happened.
Do you think it's completely privatized, or would you say that there's still a fair amount of intelligence community, you know, involvement? Maybe not the white world government, but there's plenty of black world operations in the intelligence community.
I would say there's probably connections, you know, here and there to the intelligence community, and connections here and there to the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy. But the problem is that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the majority of them probably know nothing about this. You know, the generals in the military, the admirals in the military, they don't know anything about this. If they, you know, if they're fighting an adversary, whether it's in Iraq or anywhere else around the world, they don't have access to these technologies. I mean, I wouldn't like for it to be used for warfare, but, you know, if it needed to be, they don't have access to it. And that's the problem. It's been completely removed from the official government chain of command and the military chain of command. And it's really an outrage. And it needs to be put back under control of our democratically elected officials. And the full truth about this topic needs to be revealed because our future depends on it. I mean, I would love to see congressional hearings about these topics, about the special access programs, about the crash recoveries, about the reverse engineering, about the, you know, the leeching of billions of dollars into these programs, you know, that have no accountability, that have no oversight. We need congressional hearings. And if people won't testify, then Congress needs to subpoena them and, you know, compel them to testify, make them testify. And if after we have to Congress, and all this has to be open, like I've said before, all these hearings has to be open because you cannot end UFO secrecy with more secrecy. These, you know, we need to just, the people in Congress and the Senate have to come to the conclusion before the first hearing that all of this has to be open, period. If it leaks out information, it leaks out information, too bad. We just, this has been covered up and sequestered from humanity, all these topics for too long. And it's time to just lay it all out for the world. And it might take Congress weeks or months of hearings to really get to the bottom of it. Or they, you know, and when they do, the president might have to use the military to literally go into some of these facilities and seize them and take control over it. Because these black programs might not want to relinquish what they have so easily.
If there is, like, if there is congressional hearings, if there is all of this movement, do you think that if it happened in America, it would still have a global impact? So, I mean, for example, my country, United Kingdom, very quiet. There was some kind of speculation of documents that were going to be released regarding UAPs, but it hasn't really gone anywhere as far as I'm aware. And other countries are even quieter than my own. So, I mean, do you think that if America on its own had some form of full disclosure where the Congress managed to break it all open, there was acknowledgements from all sorts of different levels of the UFO secrecy, do you think it would change the world?
Oh, yeah, it would absolutely change the world. I mean, every country in the world would be outraged at the United States for covering this up and the other countries that may have also at some point contributed to the cover-up. I mean, there may be certain aspects, and again, I doubt the majority, this is the real crime in this, I doubt the majority of the leadership of the UK, your country, I doubt they know much of anything, and they definitely have zero control over, what's going on in your country. And so I think it would be all of a sudden a global push. All these different countries around the world would very rightfully so start demanding access to this technology, start demanding access to the information, start demanding, that they be, because I really believe contact has, already began with these extraterrestrial species. I believe that it's ridiculous to think that we have spent billions and billions of dollars and done all this reverse engineering and not even opened up a communications channel with some of these ET species. And I think other countries are going to want to communicate with them. It would change everything. And when it comes to this anti-gravity technology, and it's not just anti-gravity, I keep saying that because it's the simplest term to use. But in reality, this technology, this self-organizing plasma technology, and there may be other technologies too, they probably are, but this technology allows you to manipulate mass, allows you to manipulate inertia, gravity, and maybe even the flow rate of time itself. And it also allows you to extract unlimited clean energy from the vacuum. And this is the issue. This is one big reason for the cover-up, is because they don't want the world, all these different countries around the world, to know this even exists. Even if they didn't transfer the technology to them, they cannot let them know it's even possible. Because if they do, these countries will start working on it themselves. And the reality is, it's pretty straightforward. And it's pretty simple. relatively speaking. I'm not saying that it wouldn't require a fairly advanced laboratory, and it wouldn't require very competent engineers, you know, and some smart scientists, but it wouldn't require, you know, a multi-trillion dollar effort either. You know, a modest sized country, let's say Germany, you know, once disclosure happens, you know, if the United States didn't transfer the information on how for Germany to build an anti-gravity vehicle, they would be able to start researching it. And in a year or two, they would have one. Boom. They could do it themselves. And in the process, they would develop a source of unlimited clean energy while they were at it. And so this would change the entire world, and the powers that be don't want that to happen because they want control. It's you see companies like Lockheed and other private corporations that have been involved in this. They do not want their income stream being threatened, because if in a very short period of time, virtually every country around the world would have anti-gravity vehicles that could travel throughout the solar system in days or less, that completely changes the whole aerospace industry. It revolutionizes everything. And then their, you know, corporate earnings that come in like clockwork year after year, because dominant companies like Lockheed have established themselves as a leader in their industry. You know, they are basically, Lockheed is considered the biggest and the best when it comes to, you know, aerospace contractors, and they don't want that position threatened. So this is about money. This is about greed. This is about control more than anything else. And it's really an absolute shame that the nature of humanity, their desire to keep things under control, their desire to protect their own interests before others, their desire to basically continue making money at all costs, is working against the good of the entire species.
Do you reckon that we're making steps? I mean, with 2017 being kind of a landmark year and moving forward from there with To the Stars Academy and basically a destigmatization of the subject is taking place, do you think that we've made, despite there being a lot more, you know, a lot more to be done, do you think we've made good progress?
Well, we've made some progress, some to a very limited degree, because there's more awareness of the UFO topic. A few years ago, UFOs were never spoken about, at least, you know, without lots of snickering and silly little jokes on mainstream news networks. Now, you know, in the last few years, there have been many journalists reporting about UFOs and what's happening with To the Stars Academy and the Nimitz incident and these released videos on CNN, Fox News, all these different networks. They've been willing to talk about it. So in that way, when it comes to an increase in awareness, we have made some limited progress. The problem is, though, we need to go beyond just talk. And we need to go beyond, you know, mysterious objects being seen or videotaped or caught on radar in the sky. Because the truth is, any such video is going to be argued about. The skeptics are going to jump in, come up with every crazy, logic-defying explanation they can to debunk it. They will make up crazy things saying, oh, it's a seagull. Or they'll try to say, you know, a very senior pilot with thousands of hours of flight time mistook, you know, a UFO for a conventional airplane, which is impossible. You know, they will make up every silly explanation that they can come up with. So what we really need, if we want to make significant headway in this field, we need for organizations like To the Stars Academy and others to specifically focus on the crash recoveries of the 1940s and beyond, the organizations that started, managed, and maintained the cover-up to the present day, such as Majestic 12, And also, they need to focus on the special access programs that are hoarding this technology and not releasing it to the world. They have to address these special access programs, period. They're very scared to do so. They are scared of their security clearances. People into the STARS Academy have very hard-earned security clearances. Putoff and Kit Green, I believe, are the two individuals in the United States that have had their security clearances, their top secret SCI clearances, for longer than anyone else. And they're scared of losing them. However, at some point, they need to realize, hey, they're getting older. The UFO cover-up has been continuing for decades and decades. And that unless someone does something different and takes a bold move and bucks the system, nothing's going to change. And what's so sad is Stanton Friedman, for example, he was in this field for a long, long, long time, and he contributed to the field in a major way. Yet he passed away before he could see disclosure. And if these people are into the STARS Academy, if they are not willing to buck the system and share what they know, then, you know, they may not live to see disclosure because they're getting up there in years. They're growing older. That, you know, some of them, hopefully Putoff and Kit Green and others, and they're not just to the STARS Academy. I'm talking about their entire network of people around them. Some of them, you know, that are not really actively involved in ufology, but work behind the scenes. Some of them are really getting up there in years. And if they are not willing to put the good of humanity above, you know, their security clearance, then we're going to be in the same situation we're in now 20, 30 years from now. Because the powers that be have no motivation to release the truth. You know, they're perfectly happy to keep the cover-up going as long as possible, because they're still going to get their billions either way. Lockheed and all these corporations have guaranteed earnings every single year. They're going to keep their contracts to sell ordinary jet fighters to the military. They're perfectly happy. They don't need this. They don't need disclosure. The world needs disclosure, not them. Go ahead.
So what would you say? Do you think obviously, with Lockheed being pretty much the biggest red flag defense contractor in this subject, like someone like Steve Justice, who was one of the former directors in Skunk Works, who's now on TTSA's staff aboard, like, do you think someone like him, do you think he would actually have been aware of any potential alien craft or hybrid or ARV that Lockheed had created?
Well, you have to realize, first of all, a few things here. First of all, Steve Justice, Lockheed is very compartmented. Even within Skunk Works, it's very compartmented. They have different Skunk Works, has different facilities. When I say Skunk, it gets complicated the way Lockheed is divided up. I'm trying to think of the technical name for the division that Lockheed is a part of, that Skunk Works is a part of. But they have different facilities around the country, and they probably have multiple facilities we don't even know about in bases and bunkers. So just because, even if you are a director of Skunk Works, for example, it doesn't mean you're read into every single project they're working on. You know, or if you are, you may only get the briefest of details, and you may not even get the full story. So we cannot say with confidence that Steve Justice knows anything about the reverse engineering programs. I would like to think that it's likely he has heard something since he's been in that company, you know, for a while, and he obtained a, you know, pretty high position in Skunk Works, but we just don't know for certain. What we do know is the Flux Liner and these other anti-gravity vehicles were developed in the 50s and 60s. And so there has been a lot of time for Lockheed and other contractors working with Lockheed, because I don't think it was just Lockheed by themselves. A lot of these aerospace companies share their board of directors, their vice presidents and presidents or whatever bounce around between each other all the time. So I think there are multiple companies involved, and they've had plenty of time to start very clandestine, secretive projects in the middle of nowhere, out in the desert, in some bunker, and to keep it separate, compartmented from what's happening, let's say, in the Palmdale hangar, you know, that huge hangar Lockheed has in Palmdale. I doubt there's a flux liner in there right now. Maybe in the past at some point there was. That's perfectly plausible. But, you know, actually there was a witness, Brad Sorensen, who saw the flux liner in the big hangar at Palmdale. So it was there at one point. But I doubt they, you know, take flux liners there on a regular basis. Most likely they have other facilities for them so they can limit the number of people who is exposed to the technology. It's very, very tricky how they operate. And we don't completely understand it because we're on the outside. And if we think we understand it, we really don't, because they have added even more levels to this that we cannot comprehend yet. So to answer your question about Steve Justice, if he knows something, I really wish that he would tell the world, that he would buck the system for the good of humanity, disclose what he knows, because he would be a national, not a national, a global hero. He would, even if Lockheed would get angry with him, even if the national security apparatus might get angry with him, he would be doing a tremendous service to the whole world if he disclosed what he knew about the extraterrestrial visitation of our planet and about Roswell and the Aztec UFO crash and so forth. If he knows anything, he may not know anything, but if he does, he would be doing a great service by disclosing it. But we just cannot assume one way or the other that he knows anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I find To the Stars Academy very interesting. I find the USS Nimitz event and the others, but obviously the Nimitz event's touched on more than most of them. It seems to be kind of the event that everyone's catalyzed around. I find it all to be quite fortuitous, and something that, well, I know you're already aware of this, and a few people on my YouTube channel are aware of this. But there have been some implications provided to me by an intelligence officer that the USS Nimitz Tic Tac was actually an artificially engineered scenario. The actual interfacing between Navy and some form of, you know, unmanned electromagnetic drone, essentially. And there has been some details that they provided in regards to the fact that it could have been a technological readiness test, which is something that does happen, and there was some documentation. I'm pretty sure I can bring the image up in the middle of this conversation and show people which image I'm talking about. But just in regards to the fact that there was actually some personnel that came and took away some of the sensitive bricks that had information on, and they, you know, promptly left the scene afterwards. It's interesting to me, and I just think that perhaps there's some potential to it. I don't know what your opinion is on the idea that the USS Nimitz is actually kind of an artificial bubble and, you know, almost being treated as a kind of a new Roswell or something that we can all gather behind and forget about the past.
I really think, I mean, this is just my personal opinion. I could be very wrong. Your source could indeed be correct. I tend to think that it was extraterrestrial or non-human, the Tic Tac, for the very fact that, you know, operating over a carrier group when they were going to be conducting training exercises is a safety risk. And at least from one point of view, it could even be considered illegal. It could be considered a violation of the law. So from that point of view, I think it's more likely it was something extraterrestrial, but I could be wrong, because I am completely convinced that we have reverse engineered extraterrestrial spacecraft, and we have built many different variations. Because remember, if the flux liner was built in the 60s, then Lockheed and other companies have had plenty of time to build a dozen more advanced prototypes since the flux liner.
One thing that he did say to kind of substantiate this was the fact that obviously there was no ordnance on board. It was a training scenario, which is kind of, you know, perfect because it means they can't actually fire on it. Even if it, you know, if they believe it to be a UFO, they might attempt to engage with it, which they couldn't do because they had dummy ordnance. And so that was one point that he brought up in regards to the fact that it was actually like a perfect field of testing for something like this. And I suppose in some ways it would make sense if they had something that they wanted to bring out eventually and they wanted to gauge the reactions, interactions and behaviors of their most advanced white world technology in regards to the carrier strike group and the Aegis radar system and everything that they had on board. I suppose if they wanted to test the capabilities of their most advanced naval systems against something that was similar to a UFO, the best time to do it would be within a training scenario where there was no risk of a live fire. So I suppose that element makes it somewhat feasible, but I suppose there's not enough data either way.
We don't have enough data. That's the problem. Another question I would ask is if this is top secret technology, extremely top secret, extremely sensitive, that they would not want other countries even to know that it existed, you know, why expose entire, you know, potentially thousands of people on these ships to this technology? Because, I mean, it was flying over this carrier group for a week. It was on radar, you know, and many, many people, they had to know that if, you know, if this was some sort of exercise, that many people would be exposed to this classified tech. And it seems to me that would have been a huge security risk from their point of view.
So I suppose it might have been considered human behavioral readiness as well. I mean, I'm just reaching here, but the fact that it was unmarked completely, there was no way that you would really be able to trace that back to any sort of USN drone. You know, it's just a white pill that flies around in the sky. So there isn't really a way for anyone on board to trace that back to the US necessarily.
And that's valid. That is valid. That's a valid argument. Again, it's one of these situations where we just don't know.
Right. Right.
Either way, it's phenomenal because if this is alien technology, then it means there are multiple ET species, you know, on a regular basis traveling across our planet. If it's human technology, it means we have not just had a little bit of success with gravity control, but that we have basically mastered it. So either way, whatever the truth is, the implications is enormous.
Well, if you're to believe Stephen Greer, I think he said that there was a document that he was exposed to that said that I think it was October 1953 that we supposedly cracked and mastered gravity control.
Well, we don't know if that was when, you know, they had the first successful experiments, or if that's when they built the first craft that, you know, they were able to test fly. We just don't know. Maybe he does.
Maybe.
I wish Stephen Greer would be more specific with some of this information. I mean, Stephen Greer has a lot of information because he has talked to lots and lots of people. He has talked to a lot of insiders. I just wish he would be a little more forthcoming with some of this so that we could use the information to, you know, bring about disclosure. What's your next question, sir?
Well, I suppose it might be a little controversial leading on from that, but what is your opinion on money making in the UFO community, and do we need more researchers, or do we need something of a different ilk now?
Well, what we need are bold, brave people who are willing to buck the system and put disclosure above all else. They need to put disclosure above, you know, building up their reputation, above building up their turf, you know, above getting hits to their website or selling videos. They need to make disclosure the priority, you know, and people need to, you know, try not to get buddy-buddy with other people, you know, get on their good side necessarily. They need to be, you know, urging everyone with inside information to share what they have publicly. If they think it could really have an impact on exposing the UFO cover-up, then people need to come forward and share. I mean, in today's world in ufology, you know, so many people give excuses for those people who have inside information but are not sharing it. And I understand it comes with a big risk, you know, leaking information about, you know, crashed alien spacecraft or successful reverse engineering of ET craft. Yes, there's a risk there, but this is the most important issue on the face of the earth. And like I've said before, all the time throughout history, our government and our military has sent young men and women to die in needless wars across the country, across the world, and they either don't make it back home or they come back permanently injured and maimed, and they suffer sometimes crippling disabilities the rest of their life, yet they make this sacrifice. And a lot of times, you know, it was really almost for nothing. You know, consider the wars in Iraq and all the chaos that happened over there and all the chaos that is continuing to happen over there. I mean, Iraq, you know, basically is not one country anymore. Saddam Hussein, despite the fact he was an evil man, he was holding that country together. It's no longer really one country, maybe by name, but it has fractured into many different pieces. And so the sacrifices people made over there was pretty much for nothing. Yet if you sacrifice something for UFO disclosure, it would be the most worthy cause imaginable, because you would be doing something not only for you, not only for your children and your family, not only for your country, but for the whole world and for your whole species, for the entire future of humanity, exposing this greater reality that we live in, exposing, you know, the fundamental basics of physical reality, you know, exposing to the world that, you know, we live in a giant life-filled galactic ecology of all types of life forms, you know, in exposing that God, the creator, made this universe in such a way that we can engineer it to provide for all of our needs and do wonderful, amazing things. Not only have a planet, you know, that's not polluted, have a planet that we can keep, you know, a hospitable place, but also that we can build craft that can take us to other solar systems, that we can explore this great universe God created. And I think it's really a tragedy that so many people with information that they could share that could expose the cover-up, they're holding it so close to their chest, and they're so fearful about sharing what they know. And, you know, there's many examples of this, and different people have different levels of information. But if someone has information that they think could make a real difference, I believe that if they consider themselves a patriot, if they consider themselves loyal to this country, then they should reveal it, not matter what, because it's too important not to. And there could be no greater sacrifice. If they do have to sacrifice something, if their security clearance gets yanked, you know, if temporarily they, you know, are ridiculed by their peers, or if they face some other type of adversity, it's worth it for the future of our whole civilization.
What would you say if you had the opportunity to actually meet face to face with an extraterrestrial? I mean, what would honestly be the first things that you would want to ask them?
Well, I would have hundreds and hundreds of questions.
I know
to
you
ask.
Would.
I would be talking nonstop. I mean, I guess, you know, if I was in that situation, you know, part of it would be what the context was of the situation, where I was at. You know, it would differ. You know, if I was on a table being abducted by an alien and being probed, it would be a little different than if I was at an alien.
Well, let's say they landed down and they wanted to shake hands and say hello and sit down and talk to you.
Oh, yeah. In that situation, yeah, I would be a lot more calmer, you know, than if I was undergoing some invasive medical procedure. But I would like to say, you know, who are you? Where are you from? You know, I would ask them, what are your motivations for visiting Earth? Why are you here? What are you doing here? You know, I would also like to ask them about their species, you know, their origins, where they came from, and how many other species of ETs are visiting the planet, or if some species have already been here for a very, very long time and they're not really the visitors. We're really the new kids on the block, so to speak, and they've just been here for who knows how many millennia. I'd also ask them about their beliefs when it comes to God. You know, I would ask them about, you know, if they have a religion, you know, what they know about the creator that made this wonderful universe. You know, I would ask them to explain how their ship works, how their technology works, how they can travel from star system to star system. And then finally, you know, if they did just land in my yard, I would say, hey, will you please give me some evidence that will prove to other people that I actually had this experience? Because that's what I would hate more than anything else. If they did answer a bunch of my questions and then other people just had to take my word for it that I communicated with these extraterrestrials, I would want to be able to prove somehow that I had the encounter and they gave me this information. So either they would have to give me, you know, a copy of Encyclopedia Galactica, which would be absolutely fantastic, or give me some alien device, or give me a blood sample, you know, that would have alien DNA, something that I could use to prove that the encounter was real. Let me take a videotape of the whole thing. Let me, you know, take my cell phone and go throughout their ship and take a recording of it all, you know. Something I would literally want to be able to prove that I had the encounter.
I think a lot of people feel that pain based on the amount of supposed encounters we've had and not that good amount of video footage of it. I think there's a lot of people that feel frustrated with the experience they've had, myself included. I mean, I haven't had a face-to-face experience, but I've had orange orbs flying over my head, you know, high enough for me to throw a tennis ball at them, and I wasn't able to get video footage because it happened too quickly. And I think a lot of people have had very transient experiences with the phenomena that have been, you know, completely reality changing for that person, for that individual. But then when you try and translate it to other people, if you don't have evidence, it's very difficult.
Yeah. And I can only imagine how tough it is for like alien abductees. And again,
right,
with the abductee phenomenon, with the abduction phenomena, you know, not every account of an alien abduction is real. There are people that have written things that are not true. However, I believe some alien abductions are real, and it would just be awful to experience something like that and have, you know, no concrete, irrefutable evidence that it really did happen. That would just be a terrible feeling beyond words. And I really feel for those people. And that's another reason we need disclosure, because so many people have suffered ridicule. So many people have suffered persecution. So many people have been mocked by friends and family and employers and loved ones and husbands and wives and girlfriends and boyfriends for their belief in this phenomenon. And it's really, even on a very personal level, this is serious for a lot of people, you know, and that's just yet another reason why we need disclosure. It's so important. Every way you can imagine, it's just vital that we end this cover up, this truth embargo, and, you know, basically usher in the next age of humanity.
Well, it's a bit of not much of a segue to this one, but I wanted to touch on your opinions on Elon Musk, because as he's becoming, you know, way more significant in the aerospace world of the future, his close collaborations with NASA, the fact that he himself has actually successfully launched, you know, aerospace platforms into orbit and has almost most definitely some form of, you know, video surveillance available to him up on the platforms that he's launched. Do you think he's in any degree aware of the ET presence? I would personally say that he would have to be at least to some level aware that there's strange things flying around. But do you think that there's been a sit down conversation at NASA, an NDA signed, a strict conversation?
Again, we just don't know. It's one of these things where we cannot have an absolute answer. I would guess no, because if he did know that they were flying around, then if you look at the evidence, not just from the Tic Tac, because there have been UFOs with extremely high performance, you know, capable of rapid acceleration, stopping on a dime, making right angle turns, 90 degree turns, you know, at supersonic speeds, you know, for 70 years. So Elon Musk, if he knew that, I would hope that he would not be messing around with rocketry, with chemical-based fuels, you know, designing Newtonian propulsion systems when he should be trying to develop his own anti-gravity vehicles. You know,
well, he had an interesting comment because he said, I can't actually remember where this was sourced, but I remember Deep Prasad actually spoke about it on Twitter. And it was a quote from Elon Musk after the SpaceX launch, the recent one. And I'm slightly paraphrasing here, but I believe it was something along the lines of, this is a technology made by humans for humans. Now, obviously, you know, you could read into that whatever you want, but it's a bit of an interesting comment. It's almost like he's saying, you know, rockets are our thing. And that's what I'm going with.
Well, the whole thing is, if we have to be stuck with rockets, we're never going to really explore the solar system very effectively, much less other solar systems, or traveling, you know, interstellar distances with the best rockets imaginable, with fusion, you know, conventional nuclear power plants. We're going to be lucky. Very lucky over a long period of time to get colonies on Mars, for example. It's not going to be easy. It will be tedious. It will be hard. It will be doable, but it would be very challenging. But with UFO technology, on the other hand, you know, even without the Tic Tac, forget about Tic Tac performance, a tenth of the performance of the Tic Tac. If we could build an anti-gravity vehicle with just a tenth of that performance, you know, we could have ships going back and forth to Mars every day. So they would have a constant lifeline, okay, bringing supplies, bringing new colonists, you know, bringing equipment. Or if somebody gets sick on Mars, you could bring them back to Earth the next day. It would make space travel and colonization so much easier. I mean, just exponentially easier and much more cost effective than using rockets.
What do you think about his comparison? What do you think about his AI initiatives? The Neuralink, which is obviously his end goal with that, is some form of kind of, and he's spoken about this, some form of biotechnological like convergence between man and machine. I found it kind of funny because he was always talking about, and this is Elon Musk, always talking about the dangers of AI and the risks of AI and his fears surrounding AI. But he's essentially created this company, Neuralink, and I don't know how much you're familiar with it, but he's set this company up and he seems to be justifying it as he's trying to make sure that we don't go down the bad route with AI. And a lot of Neuralink seems to be consciousness-assisted technology and the types of things that, to be honest, are almost indicative of what we've heard about in some UFO cases, in terms of the fact that the craft itself seems to be assisted through a consciousness interface with the actual technology of the vehicle. So do you think that this is a step in the right direction, or do you think that the way that he's trying to integrate awareness, consciousness, humanity basically with AI is a step in the wrong direction?
I want to give a very careful answer to this. No technology is evil. It's just how it is used. Any technology can be used for good or evil. It just depends on the application. I think there are valid applications for something that, like the Neuralink. You know, there could be medicinal applications, you know, maybe someone with Alzheimer's, you know, that's having cognitive dysfunction, they could augment them with some type of computer chip that could assist them. And maybe it could be useful in controlling vehicles, controlling craft. But I tend to think, my personal belief is that God did not intend for us to be connected to a machine. I tend to believe wholeheartedly that the combination, if we could fully recognize the significance of our consciousness and the significance of our soul, and if we could fully utilize what God has given us, you know, we are spiritual entities in a physical body. And if we could master our physical brain and master the control of our soul, then I think we would be far superior than any computer, than any cyborg type creature. We are glorious beings. We have only recognized a tiny percentage of our potential because we are so bound by our physical bodies at this moment. And we're supposed to be in physical bodies because that's how I believe God created us. We are spiritual entities that have a physical body, and we interface with the physical body through the brain. But I believe that as we develop, we're going to learn more and more and more about the potential of our spirit and consciousness and how it works with the human brain. So we will be able to do anything we want without a neural link eventually.
What's your opinion on sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that we won't need it in the long term.
Yeah.
As stopgap measure, a Neuralink might be useful for, let's say, controlling a ship or controlling a vehicle or maybe treating somebody that has a neurological disorder that can't control their body or something. You know, let's say someone with Parkinson's disease or something. But in the long term, I believe that we will just surpass it. I mean, right now, with no such interface, there are human beings that can, you know, show signs of psychokinesis. They can bend metal with their minds. They can use telekinesis, moving objects with their minds. You know, there are people that can, you know, have seemingly their ability to read minds, telepathy. And so without any, you know, computer networks augmenting their brains, there are human beings with extraordinary abilities. So I just think in the long term, we don't need them.
There's two people that kind of talk about this more than anyone else, and it's the idea, and it's Stephen Greer and James Gillian from ESETI, so CSETI and ESETI. I don't know if they get on. I don't think they do get on. I have no idea, but they never seem to talk to each other much, which just seems to be a shame to me, because I'm a fan of ESETI, James Gillian out there on the ranch. But he talks about, and so does Stephen Greer, to be fair, the idea of like the Merkaba, the energy vessel of your own physical body, and you know, the fact that at extremely advanced levels of understanding yourself and through self-realization and through essentially meditation techniques, you can astral project or travel through the universe and through the dimensions with your astral form, and that, you know, maybe this is the type of thing that is indicative of a very advanced civilization or society, when they don't even need a spacecraft. They just travel with their astral form. And, you know, maybe that's something that is required if you wanted to be on that level of true understanding without the need for a technological breakthrough. But that seems to me to be quite an advanced thing. I mean, I don't know if you've ever looked into astral projection or moving out of your body in that sense, but there seems to be quite a few people that claim to have done it.
Well, I've done research into remote viewing, and there are many amazing experiences people have had doing remote viewing sessions. You can read about Project Stargate and the various U.S. government projects that involve remote viewers. And so I believe that all of that is possible. And I think at some point in the future, we will have those abilities. But at the same time, I think that we need to be careful when we do such things, because, you know, we don't have a very good understanding of it yet. And there are all sorts of entities out there, positive and negative. So if we are astrally projecting or sending out our consciousness out into space or the universe, we have to be
small fish, big ocean.
Yes, exactly. We don't know what we may come into contact with.
I was actually going to say, I've had one experience with it, in terms of moving in some form out of my linear experience. I was sitting on my bed and I was meditating, and I had my eyes closed. It was dark in my room. My window was open, but my eyes were closed and it was completely dark. And whilst sitting there and calming my mind down, once the chatter of my thought processes kind of stopped, I actually, for a moment, could see my room, even though my eyes were closed. It kind of like my room faded into the front of my vision in the darkness, and I could see my window. And when I saw my window, I saw a plane up in the sky. This all happened very quickly. Like my vision faded in, and I saw my window, and I saw this plane. And the moment I thought about the plane, I suddenly shot towards the plane in my vision, and I flew towards it at a speed that was so quick that it probably took me about a second to actually get from my room to essentially under the wing of a plane. And the moment it happened, I freaked out and was like, oh my goodness. And then I suddenly snapped out of it and I was back in my room. But when I opened my eyes, I looked up and I looked through the window, and the plane was actually up in the sky. So it made me think, wow, did I actually perceive that plane? And then the moment I thought about the plane, my awareness seemed to travel directly towards it. And then once I kind of panicked, which didn't take long because it happened so quickly, I snapped out of it. So I've only had that kind of experience, but it makes me think that it's probably a capability that we all have innately within our operating system. But yeah, you obviously, as you said, we are uneducated in it, and we're not evolved enough, and we haven't had enough of a transparency in regards to our own abilities to probably be able to exercise these types of tools reasonably or responsibly on a whole. And I can understand and be sympathetic to your concerns of regarding this, basically because I do believe that there are all sorts of energy signatures out there, all sorts of different representations of consciousness and awareness, and you can't really be naive enough to think that it's all just going to be out there to serve your best interests. And so yeah, casting yourself out there as a little consciousness speck in that big ocean might be a dangerous thing, but it seems to also be something that is natural to the human being, and so it would seem to me that it's an important thing. It plays a role.
I think that with some people it helps them, you know, people that don't have any faith, people who believe that all we are meat computers, basically a blob of neural matter in a physical body, and when we die, we're worm food. That's it. I think these type of experiences can sometimes help the faithless realize that we have a eternal spiritual component. That, because, you know, in the Bible, it says we wear our bodies like a garment. I'm paraphrasing, you know, but our bodies are just like a garment that we put on and we take off. And so we're more than what we observe with our physical eyes and what we feel, you know, when we grab an object. We're more than that. And there's another level to us. And sometimes people get glimpses of that. I have not. I mean, I have seen a couple. We're not trying to get too deep in the paranormal, but I've seen a couple apparitions before, but I have never left my body. You know, I've never had a moment where I astrally projected, but I know people who I trust explicitly who have told me they have had experiences. They've had experiences where they were, for example, driving down the road and they were in a very calm, relaxed state, and just for some reason, they slipped out of their body and they were outside of their car and their body was still driving. They didn't crash. Their bodies, one component of the consciousness, were still driving the car. Yet from their perspective, they were above the car, you know, partially out of the roof of the car, looking around, seeing things that you could have only seen from up there. Yet they were still driving. And as soon as they started thinking too much about it, zip. They were right back in the vehicle again, in their bodies. And again, I believe that happens. I just believe that we are not ready as a species yet to really pursue that with vigor because we don't know enough about it. But that's a whole nother thing about UFO disclosure.
Yeah.
The ETs do know all about this. And maybe, you know, not all the ET species, because I don't think they're all at the same level of development. Obviously, they're all, you know, to be visiting Earth, they are all far beyond us, but they're at different levels. But they would know way more than we do, so they could educate us. And humanity deserves this information, whether we can handle it, whether we can't handle it. I believe we can. But even if we could not, humanity has the right to know. No government, no organization, no corporate entity has the right to sequester such fundamental knowledge about all these topics we have discussed tonight from humanity. It's an obscenity for them to, you know, use tax dollars and to sometimes use intimidation tactics against witnesses, like at Roswell and other incidents, to keep all of this sequestered. I mean, there were tax dollars spent for the stupid report, Roswell case closed, you know, where they claimed that Roswell was crash test dummies being thrown out of airplanes years after the Roswell incident. You know, that was an absurdity, but it was more taxpayer dollars used to lie to us. It's really absolutely sickening. It has to come to an end one way or another. And brave people within organizations like TTSA and private individuals and people who have maybe previously had been in military positions or intelligence positions, if they have information that can expose the cover-up, I believe that they would be exhibiting true patriotism and true heroism by sharing what they know. They wouldn't be a traitor. They would not be doing some grave disservice. No, they would be a liberator for humanity, because they would be opening their eyes. They would be taking the blinders off of this greater reality in which we live in, that's now hidden from us by these special access programs and their, you know, in the organizations that operate these special access programs. And it's and it has to happen for humanity to survive this stage of our evolution as a species.
Well, it's up to you, but I honestly think that's actually a really good place to maybe leave it for now and maybe do another conversation with more questions again at another time, unless you wanted to roll on with a bit more. But we are coming up on just under 2 hours now.
Okay.
So
well,
it's up to you.
I think this is good for now.
I thought that was quite a good ending statement, to be fair.
You can always have me on again. I'm always happy to chat with you.
All right. Well, I think that's a really good place to actually end this off. It's been a brilliant conversation, just under 2 hours now with Mr. X. Thank you so much for coming back and talking to us all. And I'm sure we'll have another conversation soon. Is there anything that you wanted to add before we end this off?
I just wanted to say thank you for having me. I enjoy speaking with you. And I just hope some people find the information I had to share useful. And I would like to say there's a wealth of information online about the topics that we've discussed tonight, and I urge people to do their own research and to dig into this topic, because there's information out there in plain view that the powers that be, these special access programs, would rather not you know about it. So go online, watch the documentary of the Fluxliner ARV. You know, Google Zero Point, the Fluxliner ARV. Watch the documentary. You know, look up Kenneth Radford's shoulders. That's Kenneth Radford's shoulders. And look into his research about EVOs, exotic vacuum objects. You know, do the research into gravity control. Look into the physics of the scalar and vector potentials, and that they have true physical reality. You know, do your research, do your digging, because there's a wealth of information to discover.
You heard it here, folks. So take care out there, and we'll be back sometime with another update, I'm sure of that.